Golf Smarter number 327, published on April 3, 2012, is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks, with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter.
SmarterPodcasts.com, delivering sound advice.
The NFL theme, Cowboys Golf Club, with Jeffrey Brower.
This is Golf Smarter, sharing tips and insights from golfers and golf professionals to help lower your score. It's worked for your host, Fred Green.
Welcome to the Golf Smarter podcast, Jeff.
Good morning, Fred. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you. Actually, I should be saying welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast. You are on episode number 4. I was looking it up today, so that was early in 2006. It's been quite a while since we've had a chance to speak, but...
Have your ratings recovered from that last visit?
Only increased because of you, my friend.
Great. Hard to believe, but great. All right.
No, but it's true. And I think it's because the fact that you were the first golf course architect that I interviewed on this podcast, and really started to turn my head around about what golf course design influences in a round of golf and what the golfer should learn from golf course design.
Well, it can help your score if you kind of pay attention, I guess.
So explain that. Why, how could it help your scores, and what should we be paying attention to?
Well, I think most of my brethren and I, you know, try to give you a good place and a bad place to hit the ball, you know, places where there's advantages to play your next shot if you're thinking one shot ahead. You know, most golfers just get blindly on the tee and sort of swing away as hard as they can, and that's not always the smart play.
Do you think one shot ahead when you're designing?
Oh yeah, there's always a relationship, and you know, y'all try to lay it out where, you know, a choice that you make on the tee, you know, gives you an advantage, you know, coming into the green.
What makes your design style unique, besides the name of your company? I love the word Golfscapes. But what makes your design stand out among other of your colleagues?
Well, one thing I've been told, of course, I guess it's for others to decide as much as I, but
yeah, I guess so.
My designs are, you know, sort of eclectic. I can borrow from, you know, the Golden Age style and maybe Pete Dye or 1980s style if I need to. I just don't think, consistency to me is dull. I don't think you need to be, you know, all in one style necessarily. And I actually look, you know, for example, if one hole I've got one big bunker, then the next hole might have just one small pot bunker or maybe a cluster of small pot bunkers. Whereas so many courses, you know, you start with a certain bunker style, you keep going with a certain bunker style.
So you don't get stuck in a style. You're influenced by all these different architects. Are you a student of golf course architecture as well as being a designer?
Oh, absolutely. I still love playing new golf courses. Still love studying them if I don't have time. If I get to a certain area that I've never been, I make a point of going out and actually prefer to tour maybe 4 or 5 in a hurry rather than spend, you know, 5 hours playing one. Last year I was on vacation up in Maine and realized I was close to Cape Arundel. It's famous because Clinton and the Two Bushes was the only course that hosted 3 presidents in 1 round of golf. But to me, you know, the thing was, it was an untouched course from 1901, you know, pretty much untouched. So I was able to learn, you know, quite a bit about how golf courses look back in those days. So, and that's just one example. But I love finding untouched sort of museum piece golf courses where I can.
And when you see a course like that, an untouched museum piece, I love it. Do you read about it beforehand or afterwards? Do you get fascinated and want to read more about the architect and various other designs that they've done? I'm going to say he has done.
Well, it just depends. Actually, in the case of Cape Arundel, I came about it kind of half by mistake. I mean, I drove by it and I didn't realize it. And so then I went backwards and, you know, found out about the history and that sort of things. So sometimes I'm able to plan ahead, and sometimes it just sort of happens because I've got a little extra time left over. But then I always do go back and try to find out more about it and more about the architect.
How much influence, a ton of influence because of the Golden Rule, and I'm talking about the developer of the course, the people who are putting the money up, they may come to you and say a variety of things from, here's a piece of land, go do something with it, or I need to have X amount of houses around this, or I want this to be in honor of some sort of theme. How does that work for you? How much of a renegade are you in that sense of saying, I got it?
Well, the best projects come when the owner gives you sort of a broad picture, a big picture look at what he needs, and then sort of trusts you, and then maybe double checks you every once in a while to make sure you're not going too far in some sort of goofy direction. Certainly, we always like to push the envelope a little. We like to do things, you know, a little different from course to course. You know, around here in Dallas, you know, I've done a dozen courses, so I'm very conscious of, you know, trying to make each one a little bit different. You know, when I went up to Minnesota, I had Brad Klein, a golf week up there at one point, and, you know, he mentioned that, you know, you wouldn't know the same guy designed all three courses. There's three in a 25-mile radius. And, you know, that to me is a good thing. But I let the quarry site at the Giants Ridge, you know, dictate it, you know, be sort of a Pine Valley course. And then I had another course on the lake, the Wilderness of Fortune Bay. And the first one I did was the Legend of Giants Ridge, and that was just sort of your typical Northwoods course, very traditional. So if you let the site and the owner's goals, dictate, you know, the general direction of the golf course, each one gets a sense of site, a sense of place, and they each turn out a little different.
When you get a new project, do you take a tour of the other local courses to see what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how you can make yours stand out?
I do. You know, golfers may or may not understand sort of the business aspect, but I look at other courses, you know, to benchmark mine against theirs. I mean, obviously, you know, you do well in business by building a better mousetrap. So, benchmarking it against the nearest competition is it makes good business sense for the owner.
Have you had an owner that you said, you know what, this is not going to work for me? And I'm not asking for names, obviously, but I mean, it's like the philosophies were so diametrically opposed that you just couldn't get on the same page.
You know, I've never been one of those kind of architects. Like I say, I think some guys do, perhaps, you know, fight with their owners. I don't see the point because there's just more than one way to skin a cat. And of course, hopefully, you know, while some of those stories are legendary in any design field, you would think the owner would have had those discussions before the contract was signed and the first check was written. So,
you'd think so. you mentioned a moment ago you have a dozen courses in Dallas that you've done?
Yeah, actually, I think it's a baker's dozen. I think I've done 13 in my 20-something years here.
And you're not primarily focused on local design. I mean, I would think that any job, any opportunity, anywhere in the world would be appealing.
Well, yeah. I mean, I actually probably don't do as much local work as some of my competitors here.
Oh, really?
I still enjoy the travel. It varies a little bit, but certainly like going to Minnesota when it's 105 degrees here in Texas and maybe 75 up in northern Minnesota, they got a lot of my attention those years. And, you know, we recently completed a renovation of La Costa out near San Diego. And, you know, when you get a chance to go to the world's, you know, fourth or fifth ranked resort, you know, that's a lot better than staying in Dallas-Fort Worth.
Yeah. How is La Costa? La Costa is like, you know, that's like taking a canvas that is highly recognized and then saying, so you're doing renovations, redesign. What do you do something that's that? I mean, what's the word I'm looking for here that recognizes?
Iconic, perhaps?
Yeah, thank you. Okay, thank you. I love it.
Well, that was actually Dick Wilson, and you know, I started in the business with Killian and Nugent, and as it happened, you know, in the 60s when they started their business, you know, they were benchmarking, and they looked at Robert Trent Jones or Dick Wilson for their design style, and happened to pick Dick Wilson. So sort of professional lineage-wise, you know, I was very in tune with what he was trying to do out of LaCosta. And I will mention that I teamed with Damian Pascuzzo and Steve Pate out there to do these renovations. You know, Dick Wilson style was not a big stretch for me to basically restore, you know, what he tried to do originally, because I felt pretty much that his style was very solid. His style was a little difficult. All of his greens are elevated, and he put frontal bunkers, and, you know, in playing the course with women and average golfers, you know, found a lot of shots, found those front bunkers. So as a result, we pushed them aside just a little bit, trying to make it a little more playable. But, you know, it was just fun to try to think what Dick Wilson was thinking. Actually, part of that course was done after his death by Joe Lee and some of his other associates. And so what we had to do is sort of blend it back to the best part of the golf course when Dick Wilson was still alive and still working on it. So there's always some compromises, always some value judgments, you know, Ouija boards, seance, you know, that kind of stuff. Trying to go back in time and recreate the thought process of the original architect.
How about designing on an Etch-a-Sketch?
You know, I bought one for my grandson the other day. Those darn things are addictive when you start playing with them. But
wow, you bought some for your grandson. It's like no batteries required. How'd you do that?
I was trying to get him to go old school, you know, yeah, right. Rather than video games, you know, show him what it was like back in the Stone Age to be a kid.
You're like, yeah, Gramps, thanks. Okay, can you now buy me some electronics?
That's right. What's this thing do?
Yeah, right. What's this knob for? A knob? What's a knob? Give me a button.
Right.
Give me a tap screen. Do you ever walk up to the TV and start tapping on the TV going, how come it's not working? So how is business in the United States these days for you, and what's happening internationally?
Well, I have been, I think, more fortunate than most of my brethren. Like I just mentioned, LaCosta, you know, which took up most of last year, and it's, you know, open officially. It's open to some limited play by members right now. And the year before that, we opened up Firekeeper in Mayetta, Kansas, which was a co-design with Nota Begay, Native American, you know, casino and resort.
Oh, and
great site. Golf Week, you know, just named it the top course in Kansas, supplanting actually Colbert Hills, another one of my designs, and bumping that to two, and bumping another design of mine, Sand Creek Station in Newton, to three. So I've got a hat trick going there in Kansas.
Wow.
But, you know, so that both, you know, LaCosta, because of what it is, has been getting lots of good press, and it was just a high-profile project. Firekeeper was one of only 11 new courses to open the year before. So, yeah, I maintained pretty well. On the international front, I've done some legwork in China. You know, nothing has gotten under construction, which is actually pretty typical over there. There's a lot more projects start than get under construction. Just hard to know who's for real over there.
Yeah. So it's something you kind of shy away from, doing the international stuff, as long as you can keep busy here in the States?
Well, no, my kids are all in college or out of college now, so, you know, I did some international work 20 years ago, you know, while they were too young to know I was gone, I guess,
mm-hmm.
and sort of shied away for a long time for family reasons. But now, you know, I've been pursuing it, but I you know, like I said, it's so hard to know who's for real. I've been working rather than going to the golf shows and chasing stuff willy-nilly. If I can get a recommendation through a mutual friend and somebody I know, you know, then I'll do some work over there. I spent a lot of time running around 20 years ago, and, you know, that doesn't pay. I know some of the architects have spent $250,000 chasing work and, you know, maybe have one course under construction. So just a hard market to know.
This episode of the Golf Smarter Podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the Internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible would like to provide Golf Smarter listeners with an opportunity to try Audible with a free audiobook of your choice from their enormous library. One audiobook to consider is boys will be boys. The glory days and party nights of the Dallas Cowboys dynasty. From the publisher's description, they say they were America's team. The high-priced, high-glamour, high-flying Dallas Cowboys of the 1990s, who won three Super Bowls and made as many headlines off the field as on it. In similar fashion to his New York Times bestseller, The Bad Guys Won, award-winning writer Jeff Perlman chronicles the outrageous antics and dazzling talent of a team fueled by ego, sex, drugs, and unrivaled greatness. Rising from the ashes of a 1-15 season to 1989 to capture three Super Bowl trophies in 4 years. Boys Will Be Boys, The Glory Days and Party Nights of the Dallas Cowboys Dynasty. You can get this book for free by signing up for a new account today at audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. That's audiblepodcast.com/golfsmarter. By the time that this episode of the Golf Smarter podcast gets published, I will have already returned from my weekend trip to play a couple rounds in Dallas. And that's why I got back in touch with you, is because one of the courses that, while I was doing my research, one that hopefully we'll have up some video of it on Golf Smarter TV very soon, is the only NFL-themed course in the United States. And I thought, that sounds like a great story. And in doing some reading, I saw your name associated, so I had to call you. Tell me about the Cowboys Golf Club.
You know, the project started about 1989, ended up taking until 2001 to get it open. But one of the hotels there, Hilton Conference Center, had the idea to put a golf course right there next door. And it's near the airport, and just a great in-town location. The land is actually Corps of Engineers land that had been leased by the city of Grapevine, Texas, for 100 years, and they had built a public course there. So it was just a fantastic site, untouched, heavily wooded, core golf course, just waiting for something to be done. And anyway, the Hilton worked their way through, and we're looking for financing and whatever, but through contacts, somebody knew Jerry Jones, and he expressed interest in becoming a partner in the golf course and doing an NFL-themed golf course. And in Dallas, Texas, we have all 100 courses here, and we've had all the signature designers and whatnot. And probably there's no better theme or brand in Dallas, and maybe a lot of other places, than the Dallas Cowboys. So when Mr. Jones decided to come on, it just seemed to fit together.
He must have been very excited. Whose idea was it to say, look it, now that you're here, we've got this idea? Like, yes.
Yeah. Well, his partner in the project is Evergreen Alliance Eagle Golf.
Okay.
I think, and the Hilton maintains a small portion of the project, too. And somehow they just knew each other and, decided it would be a great thing. And Jerry, and even more Stephen Jones, his son, unlike his reputation for, managing his football team, being very hands-on, I thought he was a great, great guy to work for. We had some early meetings and then some, critical site reviews, and like I say, gave us the big picture. And, oddly enough, at early discussions, he says, we'll do the theme in the clubhouse, but I like traditional golf courses, so let's not, do any gimmicks. You go out there. The putting green was originally shaped like a Dallas star, the Cowboys star.
Sure.
And down the fourth hole, which has a huge elevated tee and it's got a chance of laying up or driving the green, they did put out the blue star logo out in the middle of the fairway as sort of the target for the layup. But there's a stone monument at every tee sort of commemorating the history, 1 through 18, early start of the team through their Super Bowl victories. And they've left some room for some artwork, which has not been put out there over the years. But basically, you'll go out and you'll see it's just a great, core course, a traditional course, heavily wooded, and, just a lot of fun to play with just touches of the Cowboys theme.
So it's not like you're teeing off and all of a sudden somebody in pads just comes and knocks you over. I mean, it's not like a roller coaster ride. It's not a theme park.
No, that would be a tough course.
This is a par 65. hole, par 65. Yeah, and it's so what hole should I be, if I have my camera, if I have some video with me, what are the signature holes that I should be looking towards that are visually compelling?
Well, holes 2 and 4 both have, you know, maybe 70 or 80 foot drops from the tee. Very unusual for the Dallas area, and most people say, "Wow, this feels like a hill country course rather than a, you know, down near Austin rather than Dallas." Hmm. So those get a lot of attention, and then it plays along the valley, and then, you know, coming back uphill, the 17th hole is a long par 3, one of the few uphill par 3s I've ever designed, and it really is spectacular. Heavily bunkered, and there's a tough pin back left, which of course has been dubbed the, you know, coffin corner. Try to get your punt to land on the, you know, the corner in the 5 yard line or something. So the rest is just very solid, very traditional. Those big downhill and uphill holes seem to grab the most attention, just because it's different for Dallas Fort Worth.
So using the Cowboys brand, not even their name, just being branded by the Cowboys, is more of a marketing appeal than something that caught your eye design-wise?
Yeah, I mean, I was really grateful when Mr. Jones and others, you know, decided to keep it as traditional golf. You know, could have turned out like a circus or Disneyland, had you taken that to some illogical extension. So I think they hit it just right on the overall theme. I mean, the Cart girls wear Cowboys jerseys. There's a replica Super Bowl trophy in the clubhouse and whatnot, but... for me as an architect, we really did have a free hand. I mean, Mr. Jones, like I say, big picture, he says, "I like traditional golf. Don't give me goofy greens," although we did push the limit there because older courses tend to have more rolly greens than new ones, so we wanted to get some roll in them to make them feel old. Actually, the thing that really works, again, with the Cowboys is they're actually as busy during the week with corporate events as they are on the weekend with, you know, casual golfers. I mean, that's where it's aimed. It's just a great place to take your clients out and entertain them. You know, the true country club for a day. They knock you out with service. They have meeting rooms in the clubhouse. And as a result, you know, trying to make tee times, it's harder sometimes to get them on a Thursday than it is on a Saturday or a Sunday morning, because they book corporate outings both morning and afternoon.
Right, and you told me that, we were talking about playing an early Sunday morning round because we have to get back to the airport soon after that. And you're like, "Oh, Sunday morning, not a problem. That's going to be easy to get a tee time."
Well, and actually, they give you a special deal. Even on Sundays, they book the 8 and the 1 o'clock shotguns because they've remained popular and they have not cut their fees despite the economy.
Wow.
They're maintaining the brand rather than discounting, so much like so many other courses have done.
Well,
and successful at it.
Yeah, they need bodies out there. So you're saying that beyond number 2, number 4, number 17, I got to check out the clubhouse.
Well, it's impressive. It is impressive. You'll enjoy that, the whole experience. They just do a great job out there.
You said that you've, that number 17, a long uphill par 3, that you've not done a lot of uphill par 3s. So when you're looking at a hill, you're at the base of a hill, and you're trying to imagine what you're going to do. What makes you say, this should be a par 3 and not a par 4, or maybe we should stretch this out and turn it into a par 5? How do you determine what goes where when you're standing on a fantastic site?
Oh, well, the Architects Union would say that I'd tell you that, but then I'd have to kill you, the 17th was just one of those deals where it tends to be the par 3s. Of course, they're always the easiest to stick in, because it's a single-shot hole. And the par 4s and the par 5s, depending on the kind of ground, I mean, some holes just call out, topography just calls out for a certain thing. And, usually you'd like the tees elevated, like 2 and 4, like we talked about. Usually I like to place the greens in gentle upslopes because it just gives them a nice setting. And, when you're routing it, people are always disappointed when they come to the office because, every architect, not just me, has these little plastic golf holes where you can just kind of move them around on the plan, and try out a lot of different things, quickly. When I have the guys routing courses, for me to review and look at, I tell them if they can't get the first 10 routings done in a half an hour, you know, and then take, you know, then you start refining and taking ideas from each. It's just almost a numbers game. You got to be open to try a lot of different things. And like I said, usually you'll find 3 to 4 holes just cry out to go, you know, clearly where they are, you know, maybe 6 or 7 on a great site. And in other cases, you know, you do have to make those choices. Well, I could extend this to the next hill and make it a par 5, or I could move it over here and make it a short 4. So, you know, every site just presents a real different challenge.
And so the term golfscapes, I mean, every canvas is unique, huh?
Every canvas is unique. You know, when I was doing the 2 courses up in Minnesota, it was funny. They asked me, is it different? And I said, well, the process is the same. But, you know, one course I was in the quarry and there's big pits everywhere. And the changes of topography that you want to use to create the golf hole, you know, were very abrupt. And on the other course at the Giants Ridge, the changes were long and broad. But, you know, you still look for the same sort of changes of topography to utilize. It's just they're different on every site.
Mm-hmm. You said visually, you look at it visually. So how often is it you're saying it's visually demands the type of hole it is versus strategically demands on what you design?
Yeah, you know, and some people like years ago, I remember Jack Nicklaus said there's no great uphill holes, you know, like the 17th we were just talking about. And really as a golfer, you know, basically what he's saying is you want to see where you're going. And, you know, obviously that's easier to do downhill. And then things, you know, like say the greens usually present best in a gentle uphill setting. So you're sort of looking for that down to up sort of relationship. I mean, there's a couple different variations of it that you can use. And a great golf hole, you know, the bones of a hole or the routing, you know, I do tend to look at it visually as much as anything.
How locked in are you on the concept of got to have 2 par 3s in the front and 2 par 3s in the back and 2 par 5s in the front? Or do you like, you know what, I'm going to go 3 and 3 on this one, or I'm going to go 1 and 2 or 1 and 3?
Well, one of my courses here in Dallas, Westridge, up near in McKinney in the northern suburbs, is actually a 6-6-6 routing. And, you know, to answer
Hooray!
Your question, I...
You mean like...
Yeah, there you go.
I've always wondered why, you know, somebody can't go out and play 6 holes or 12 or 18. Is that what you're saying? Is instead of like a front nine, back nine, or is it a...
That's traditional routing. I mean, 9 comes back to the clubhouse.
Oh, okay.
It's got 6 par 5s, 6 par 3s, 6 par 4s.
Okay. Oh, interesting.
Again, just a way to make one of my dozen, you know, courses here, you know, unique.
I want to play there.
So, and to be honest with you, because in reality, the par 4 is still the most efficient hole in golf. I mean, you hit a tee shot, and again, you have some strategy, or at least, you know, hit the fairway, or you hit the rough, and, you know, makes your approach shot harder, or the angle that you take. And then you have the approach shot, which, of course, sets up the putt. You know, the third, or the middle shot on a par 5 is usually fairly boring, unless you can, you know, make it a great heroic hole. You know, par 3, there's no real strategy. I mean, you can have a concept of how you hit the shot, but there's no relationship between the shots. So you add in the, you know, the acreage that it takes and the fact that long hitters are just making a joke out of par 5s, and I really feel the future of golf is going to be in par 70 or maybe even par 69 golf courses. And the U.S. Open has been doing that, USGA for their U.S. Opens, you know, for years. And, you know, really, I think par 72 will go the way of the dodo bird here in a decade or so, and it will focus more on par 70.
And what about the way courses seem to be dictated by the tour on getting longer and longer and longer? Is that playing into, you know, into the long hitter's hands, or is that definitely makes it a more difficult course?
Well, I have really been reacting the other way. I mean, if I go play with average golfers, you know, golf in America, the guy, 63% of players, nearly 2 out of 3, play at 6,300 yards, and even that, you know, might be a little long for them. 20-something years ago, I played in the Las Vegas Celebrity Pro-Am, and I got paired with the likes of Fuzzy Zeller and Tom Watson and Jim Colbert and Calvin Peet, and, you know, granted, they maybe hit a little farther those days, but I was just behind them. And so, you know, the idea of them playing 7,000 and me playing 6,700 yards made a lot of sense. But, you know, Bubba Watson's 100 yards by me these days. And so I personally, and I see a lot of golfers just realizing you can't keep up with the tour pros. And, you know, so I see a lot of golfers, of course, I'm 57 myself now. So I see a lot of golfers going from that 6,800-yard tee to 63. You know, my dad, when he played, would never play under 6,000. But I see a lot of seniors now realizing that, you know, if the scorecard doesn't give them an option at 56 or 5,800 yards, they realize over 6,000 is too long. And so anyway, I'm a big advocate of shortening golf courses, ignoring that 0.1% and hit the ball 300 yards or more, because really that's so few. I did Wild Wing Resort a few years ago, and I called the superintendent. I said, hey, how many people use that those back tees at 72, 50? He goes, well, 50. I said, well, is how many of that a week, a month? He goes, that's 50 in the 10 years the course has been open to play the back tees.
Oops.
So, you know, to paraphrase, you know, Winston Churchill, never has so much golf course been built for so few.
Did he really say that?
Really. Well, he said never has so much been done for so by so few or something, referring to World War II and the soldiers.
Of course.
So, shamelessly paraphrasing a great man there. But I think most courses I always propose to the owners that let's just ignore the pro tour. Those guys aren't going to show up. Yeah, even, you know, your good amateurs who come and play, the number who hit it over 300, very, very small. And, you know, then you can build a 6,800-yard golf course, and you don't spend that much money. You know, you don't use that much acreage. There's not as much irrigation to put down and so on and so forth. All for one-tenth. Yeah, all for those 50 tee times, you know, even 50 a year. It's an awful lot of expense going in. So to me, I see that happening. Golf courses, the designs being more targeted. It's an interesting philosophical concept. I mean, to stretch a course to 7,600, you know, we have really just tried to build every golf course to accommodate every golfer, and spent a lot of resources doing it. And I think in the, you know, in the future, I mean, you look at like a Prestwick in Scotland got out of the British Open rotation. And, you know, you see the tour going to more and more to the TPC courses designed specifically for tournaments. Again, I think we'll see more targets, you know, maybe some courses for women or junior facilities. You know, maybe you go to Florida, a lot of those courses might get shortened up to that 5,600 because they're aimed more at seniors. I mean, you know, why in a Florida retirement community do you need 7,200-yard tees?
Right. That makes total sense, unless that they demand. It's like, no, I've got to get this course on the tour if we're going to be selling a lot of tee times here. People want to be able to play on courses they said that has been on the tour, right?
Well, that's still going to be 55 courses out of 15,000 or, you know,
yeah,
something in that variety, maybe 100 if you include the women's tour. I mean, La Costa is hosting the Kia, the LPGA to event this week, but it's just funny. Almost every design I go to, you get out there, and of course, it's usually the good players, you know, who get involved with that. And, you know, we stand on those tees talking about tournaments that might come. And like I say, La Costa is one of the few that, you know, has hosted the PGA tournament, may do it again. It has great success with the LPGA. But, you know, there it makes sense. You know, at most other places, you know, we spend an hour talking about how the tour pro would play this all, and, you know, they just aren't showing up. It's a waste of my last 20 minutes to discuss that.
A moment ago you said there's no strategy in a par three. You just want to get, you know, the ball to the green. But on a design sense, if I remember you talking about this, because it's kind of always stuck with me, is that you put in visual distractions on a par three to mess with the golfer, you know, like bunkers and water and, you know, things like that. So it's not just a clear shot at the green, right?
Yeah. I mean, I always felt that, of course, I've been a fan of McDonald and his protege, Seth Rayner. And, you know, their par threes were always what I call concept shots. And I tend to do the same thing. I either do a small green totally surrounded by bunkers, you know, so it's a real precision shot, or they would do what's called a Redan shot where the green has sort of a reverse slope and, you know, you had to play to the front right corner to get it on the green. Without the interrelationship of shots, you know, between the tee shot and hitting the approach, like I said, I think par threes are just great great holes to just test a certain kind of shot from the golfer and to make up for that. Hmm.
Well, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It was great to talk to you again. I cannot wait to play the Cowboys Golf Club and go to the clubhouse and get some photos of 2, 4, and 17 and have some fun playing golf in Dallas. Thanks so much for coming back. It's great to talk to you.
Well, I will come out there and join you and heckle you all the way around. How about that?
Just what I needed.
All right. Fred, thanks a lot. I enjoyed it.
Well, recently we've spoken to architects Trip Davis in today's show with Jeff Brower about course design and what it means to the average golfer. This past weekend, I was in Dallas, and I did play the three courses we've talked about. And since I've not had a chance to play in Scotland, I don't have a full appreciation of links-style courses. So the Tribute was interesting, but it didn't capture my eye the way Old American or Cowboys Golf Club did. It's always great to finish a round at a new course saying, oh, now that I've seen what's there, I want to play this course again. That's what I felt about both the Old American and the Colony, and definitely about Cowboys Golf Club in Grapevine, just north of the airport in Dallas. Beyond the plaques commemorating great moments in Dallas Cowboys football history at each tee box, the course was far from what you'd call gimmicky. Challenging, extremely pleasing to the eye, and actually had some unique features that I've never seen at any other golf course. So I did shoot some video, and I interviewed the head pros at each of the three courses that I played. So stay tuned for the announcement of when those videos will be available on our youtube.com/golfsmarterTV channel. You can find, we have over 40 videos there now. So if you're on YouTube, just type in golfsmarterTV. That's one word. Another way to do it is right on our website. We have a link right there, and it'll keep you on the website and allow you to see all of our videos. Now, next up is a members-only episode, so I invite you not to miss a single show and gain complete access to our archives of 7 years of Golf Smarter Podcast. Please help us keep this listener-supported podcast alive by joining Golf Smarter for members only at golfsmarter.com.
Smarterpodcasts.com. Delivering sound advice.